Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's virtual event. This afternoon, June 29th, we discuss COVID-19 vaccines and intellectual property. Today's event is sponsored by the Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, the International Law Practice Group, and the Intellectual Property Practice Group. My name is Evelyn Hildebrand, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us a really fantastic panel. I will introduce our moderator, who will then introduce our speakers. Mr. Stephen Tett will be moderating the discussion this afternoon. Stephen is the president and CEO and the founder of Sentinel Worldwide. He is also a professorial lecturer in law. He teaches intellectual property at George Washington University. Stephen is also a member of the Federalist Society's Intellectual Law Practice Group. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will turn to the audience for questions, so be thinking of those as we go along. In the event you do have a question, please enter it into the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. With that, thank you for being with us today, and Stephen, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Evelyn, and thanks to the Federalist Society. In less than a year after the COVID pandemic hit, not one, but three different vaccines were invented, led by three American companies whose names are etched in the public consciousness: Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson. Each of these vaccines boasts phenomenal levels of effectiveness. Last October, before any of these vaccines were available to the public, the nations of India and South Africa proposed to the World Trade Organization that they suspend requirements of member countries to provide protection to not only patents, but also trade secrets, industrial designs, and even copyrights, all of which are provided for in the TRIPS agreement. To be clear, this was not a proposal to take advantage of the agreed flexibilities that had already been negotiated into the text of TRIPS. This TRIPS waiver proposal, as it's known, would allow nations to suspend all protection and enforcement of intellectual property rights covered by the waiver. Few were surprised to see longtime anti-IP governments and like-minded activists rally around the proposal. But on May 5th of this year, in the face of ballooning infection rates abroad and increasingly sharp criticism from the far left, the Biden administration announced it was open to text-based negotiations on a TRIPS waiver. By all accounts, this decision was made without consultation with foreign allies, Congress, or even the relevant expert agencies within the executive branch. Since that announcement, Republicans have criticized the decision for risking emboldening IP theft by countries like China and Russia. And there's even been a backlash to some degree on the left, with experts noting that extensive international licensing agreements already in place have essentially maximized global vaccine production. Meanwhile, a variety of other nations that some expected to fold with the reversal of the US position have in fact held firm in their skepticism of the waiver proposal, focusing on the practicalities of the supply chain for vaccine ingredients, global distribution, and foreign countries' own regulatory barriers to importing vaccines. Meanwhile, the private sector forecasts they could produce as many as 10 billion vaccine doses by the end of the year. We all want to put an end to COVID everywhere as soon as possible. Would a waiver of IP obligations help end the pandemic sooner, or is the private sector moving faster than governments? What would be the long-term fallout from waiving whole sections of the TRIPS agreement? Even if there is no waiver, what are the long-term implications of the Biden administration's embrace of the concept? We have an all-star panel to address these and other questions. I will give brief introductions now in the order that they'll be speaking. More extensive biographies are available online on the Federalist Society website. Jim Baucus is a member of the Herbert A. Stiefel Center for Trade Policy Studies, the Distinguished University Professor of Global Affairs, and Director of the Center for Global Economic and Environmental Opportunity at the University of Central Florida. He was a founding judge and twice the chairman, the chief judge, of the highest court of world trade, the appellate body of the World Trade Organization in Geneva, Switzerland. George Contreras teaches in the area of intellectual property law, and genetics in the law. He's recently been named one of the University of Utah's Presidential Scholars and won the 2018-19 Faculty Scholarship Award from the S.J. Quinney College of Law. Professor Contreras has previously served on the law faculties of American University, Washington College of Law, and Washington University in St. Louis, and he was a partner at the international firm of Wilmer, Cutler, Pickering, Hale, and Doerr, where he practiced transactional and intellectual property law in Boston, London, and Washington, D.C. Brooke Baker teaches disability discrimination law negotiations and a new course on human rights, intellectual property, and access to medicines at the Northeastern University School of Law. Professor Baker is an honorary research fellow at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa. He's also a senior policy analyst for Health Gap Global Access Project and is actively engaged in campaigns for universal access to treatment, prevention, and care for people living with HIV/AIDS, especially expanded and improved medical treatment. Anna Santos-Rushman is an assistant professor at St. Louis University School of Law. She's published and presented widely on topics relating to health, law, food and drug regulation, intellectual property, innovation in the life sciences, and law and technology. In 2020, Professor Rushman was selected as the featured young scholar at the VOTS Roundtable at the annual meeting of the American Society of International Law. So we begin with you, Professor Bacchus, please.
Thank you so much, Stephen, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate today. This is the first time I've been asked by the Federalist Society to participate in an event. I look forward to doing more in the future. I thought I might begin with a bit of history leading up to this COVID-19 quandary about intellectual property in the WTO. Among my other sins that was not mentioned, I'm both a former trade negotiator for the United States and a former member of the Congress of the United States. And I was one of those who was most intimately involved in the congressional efforts in support of concluding the Uruguay Round trade agreements back in the early 1990s that, among other things, established the WTO and introduced the TRIPS agreement on trade-related intellectual property rights into the trading system. We did so at that time because increasingly more and more of the value of every traded good was to be found in the intellectual property contained in it. In the United States, of course, there are millions upon millions of jobs that depend on the protection of intellectual property rights. And increasingly, this is so worldwide, not just in developed countries, but in the developing world as well. In the 25 years since the conclusion of the TRIPS agreement, this has not changed. But we've had 25 years of battling over what the TRIPS agreement means in the interim. Significantly, at the outset, the WTO members who concluded the agreement, developed and developing countries together, established a balance within the agreement between the exclusivity sought by intellectual property right holders and the access sought by people throughout the world in need of new knowledge who wanted to speed innovations more quickly throughout the world and share them among all the people of the world. If you look at the intellectual property debate, on the extremes, on the one hand, you find IP right holders and advocates who really would prefer absolute IP rights, you know, without any limitation during the time in which they exist. On the other extreme, you will find those, some of them in NGOs, others elsewhere, who don't really accept the concept of intellectual property rights, who don't really feel that innovations and creations that are subject to IP rights should be eligible to be treated as property. Rather, they see all these innovations as, in their nature, something that ought to be treated as public goods. And this is especially the case in terms of medicines. These are the extremes. Neither of these extremes is represented in the TRIPS agreement. The TRIPS agreement strikes a balance, as I said, between exclusivity and access. And it does so basically by, on the one hand, establishing a global minimum expected as a standard for the protection of patents, copyrights, trademarks, trade secrets, and other IP rights. And on the other hand, providing, since you're all lawyers, this is in Article 7 and Article 8 of the TRIPS Agreement, and also in the preamble, that countries can, in pursuit of their own domestic policies, limit IP rights when they feel it's needed for social, economic reasons, including health and nutrition. So we've had this debate that has been ongoing within the system for a quarter of a century. The last time we had such controversy was in the HIV/AIDS crisis. And that's not a debate we want to repeat, because that struggle legally went on for years. It was ultimately resolved, and I think in the right way, but not until after some years had gone by, when a lot of people who needed those HIV/AIDS drugs in the developing world were not able to get them because they were so costly. That was a discussion over compulsory licensing. And there are now clear WTO rules that establish that compulsory licensing is permissible under the TRIPS agreement. That's the one amendment we've made to the agreement. I would have argued under the existing rules that it was permissible, but now it's clearly permissible. Yet, as Steve mentioned, what's being suggested now in the waiver proposal that was originally put forward by South Africa and India, and has since been joined by many countries around the world, including the United States, in one of the most interesting actions of the Biden administration, would go beyond just the question of compulsory licensing. With compulsory licensing, of course, there continues to be compensation of the right holder. But we're talking, at least as this waiver was originally proposed, and going beyond that to simply waive a whole array of IP rights with respect to these COVID vaccines. Now, negotiations are ongoing, and I think that if we are able to reach a consensus on some type of WTO action, it will not be framed by any means as extensively as originally proposed. The Indians and the South Africans, for example, initially said, well, we'll decide later when this waiver ends. Now they're talking about a specific time limit, and other details are still to be discussed. But the fundamental question that is not really being asked, in my view, is will, in fact, this waiver actually do something to help accomplish a speedier end to the pandemic, and also do something effective to counter what I consider the shameless global outpouring of vaccine nationalism that we've seen over the past 15 months and more. That really is not a question that's been answered. As I've looked at this issue, it seemed to me to be an issue relating not to IP rights, but to production and distribution. And in my view, the political capital that's being spent on the waiver would better be spent on encouraging much more in the way of international cooperation to increase production in some of these developing countries, and also in the developed countries as well, and also do much more to speed distribution. With the coming of the Biden administration in the United States, the attitude has changed some, and also with respect to the fact that we've reached certain vaccination levels, it becomes easier to advocate sending vaccines overseas. They're doing more I don't think nearly enough is being done. And I don't think nearly enough is being done all over the world by developed countries to do things that are needed to end the pandemic, and especially to make certain that these medicines are available to those who most need them in the poorer countries of the world. I'll stop here.
Great. Thank you very much. Professor Contreras, please.
Great. Thanks very much. And thanks for inviting me to speak with you today. I won't add much to what Professor Bakker said, much of which I agree with very much. But I want to draw out just a couple of the misperceptions that I see floating around in the news, particularly when this topic is raised. So first, as Professor Bakker mentioned, this is not really a new concept. The TRIPS Agreement, which dates to 1995, did contain flexibilities that allowed countries to grant compulsory licenses to ensure the adequate supply of patented products in their countries, subject to adequate remuneration. In 2001, the Doha Declaration, which a number of countries acceded to, adds aspects of public health protection to that. And in the two decades since those instruments came into effect, a number of countries over the years, Thailand, South Africa, India, Brazil, have imposed compulsory licensing regimes for diseases including AIDS, HIV, cancer, heart disease, drugs. At the outset of the COVID-19 pandemic in sort of February, March of last year, a number of countries reacted quickly to impose measures that also sounded in compulsory licensing. Israel, Canada, Chile, Ecuador, and a couple later, Indonesia and Brazil, also imposed those sorts of measures. And all of that already allowed under the TRIPS agreement flexibilities. And so the addition that we see here, the possible extension of this with the October 2020 India-South Africa proposal is twofold. First, it would dispense with the compensation provisions that exist under TRIPS, but more importantly, to some degree, is it expands the scope of the waiver beyond the traditional compulsory licensing rights, which relate to patents, to trade secrets. And trade secrets are the most important of the rights that are subject to the new proposal. And what does that mean? You know, interestingly, a lot of the discussion around this waiver hasn't really focused on trade secrets. There are, you know, patents are not that difficult from an implementation standpoint to license on a compulsory basis, right? A patent in a particular country gives a legal right to exclude within that country. If the patent rights are licensed on a compulsory basis or they are waived, then operators in that country can manufacture and sell the patented article. It doesn't require the holder of the right to do anything, but a requirement that trade secrets be licensed or made available or transferred actually requires effort on the part of the rights holder generally, from a potentially small amount of effort, as in handing over data from clinical trials or factory layouts or manufacturing processes that are written down, to much more extensive disclosures, technical training, and technical assistance that, as I think we'll hear from our next two speakers, are much more important in the world of vaccines than they are in the small molecule world, and certainly with respect to non-drug-related or mechanical devices, right? So this would be an interesting move and really somewhat unique and novel in this area. Like, there have been attempts by countries to require technology transfer, the disclosure of trade secrets. And a fair portion of the U.S. Trade disputes with China over the last several years have related to what's been called forced technology transfer, FTT, requirements that the U.S. alleged the Chinese government imposed in order to permit U.S. and other foreign companies to do business in China. You have to enable either Chinese partners or Chinese companies or disclose secrets to the Chinese government in order to get that right. And the U.S. opposed those measures strenuously over the last few years. Today, we're seeing a very interesting reversal of position, as Professor Bacchus mentioned, with a potential support of that type of transfer. This switch was forecasted, actually, in what's called the Special 301 report that the U.S. government issues every year relating to the trade status of various countries around the world. In the 2020 Special 301 report, and pretty much everyone before that for many years, there was a pretty clear condemnation of compulsory licensing measures taken by countries. Whereas this year in 2021, just a few weeks before the support that the USTR gave to the South Africa-India proposal, you see an affirmative endorsement of compulsory licensing. And that was little noticed in the community. I mean, I didn't notice it until May 5th, and we got the announcement from the USTR. But it will be really interesting to see what the U.S. ultimately comes out supporting. It is not a co-signatory or co-sponsor, as far as I'm aware, yet of the India-South Africa proposal, which has over 60 co-sponsors. But the U.S. is supportive. And so how this will actually be implemented in a waiver at the WTO remains to be seen. And I think will be quite interesting to watch unfold. So with that, I'll turn the floor back over to my colleagues.
Great. Thank you very much. Professor Baker, please.
Well, it's great to be on the panel and also to have two presentations already set the stage so well with respect to some of the key issues that are before us. I'll be honest and clear. I'm probably the most IP skeptic person on the panel by a considerable degree. And my work primarily in the past is focused, as stated in the introduction, on trying to overcome the intellectual property barriers that had prevented access to life-saving antiretroviral therapy for HIV and AIDS. And in the current context, have witnessed the, I would actually say, grotesque vaccine nationalism and inequitable supply of COVID vaccines, but also personal protective equipment, diagnostic tests, the first therapies that we have available to people around the world who have as much need for those technologies as we do here in the United States. And so when I look at the current situation, I do analyze it quite differently. One thing I'd like to emphasize at the beginning is that the U.S. and actually many other governments and private foundations invested massively in the research and development and a clinical trial of some of the promising technologies that have been developed, including virtually all of Moderna's R&D costs were actually funded, and clinical trial costs were funded by the U.S. Pfizer's, actually the inventor of the product, were Turkish inventors, but they were working at a German biotech, which then partnered with Pfizer. But BioNTech got substantial resources from Germany. And so there has been major investment in de-risking of the R&D effort, which I think needs to be taken into account in thinking who should receive the benefits, should the global population receive the benefits of scientific progress. We have learned in this pandemic, what in the AIDS pandemic, we focused mainly on the impact of exclusive patent rights on prices. We now realize that the exclusive rights also give the right to control supply, price, and distribution. And what we have at present is inadequate supply, needlessly high prices, several times over the cost of production, and completely inequitable supply, where the people in rich countries have 60 plus times the access to COVID vaccines that people in low income countries have. The companies who have the exclusive rights have tried to increase internal capacity somewhat, and they've entered into contract manufacturing agreement with other producers, but largely within the existing big pharma cartel. And they've also, faced some barriers which need to be overcome. I think there are proposals that address these, the supply bottlenecks and shortfalls, the impact of export controls and prioritization of certain producers, for example, under the U.S. Defense Production Act, which at least temporarily interfered with supply of key vaccine components to manufacturers elsewhere in the world, including in India. But what we've seen has largely been a case of vaccine manufacturers and right holders being unwilling to engage in large-scale technology transfer to all capable producers that have existing capacity or repurposable capacity to massively scale up vaccine manufacturing in the short term. The U.S. made the investments in expanded manufacturing capacity, and companies began to manufacture at risk over a year ago. And we see many news stories about that. And they did begin to enter into these more restrictive partnerships. Well, what they weren't willing to do, despite the foreseeable need for vaccination that would reach the entire world, what they didn't do is really sharing the technology broadly. And so, in the face of that, it is certainly true that the waiver proposal in October preceded actual authorization or vaccine introduction anywhere in the world. But at that point in time, India and South Africa and other supporting countries had seen that the US, Europe, and UK had rushed to the front of the line and procured disproportionate access to first products through advanced purchase agreements and options, such that we get exactly what we see now. There's been a supply that wasn't quite quick enough, but essentially has become, is now adequate for needs in the US and Europe. And yet in Africa, less than 2% of the population has received even a first dose of a COVID vaccine. And they're suffering a third wave of infection because of the new Delta variant, which has entered their populations. So the question is, well, what should we do in the face of massive undersupply and inequitable distribution when companies have not voluntarily agreed to expand production on their own and to share technology? Should we sit idly? Should government sit idly? Should populations and public sit idly? Or should we put pressure on drug companies? To me, the waiver is a method of pressure on drug companies to do more, to expand production and equitably supply. If we were forced to rely solely on the waiver, it would take a period of time for it to be realized. I think it's important to pursue because I think it's important as a pragmatic measure to bring the drug companies to the table in a different way, to engage in more proactive licensing and technology transfer. And I think contrary to what was suggested early on, is this does not have to be without compensation. I mean, Jorge is right, George is right that the waiver itself says nothing directly about compensation, though the revised waiver that's been submitted does acknowledge that there needs to be incentives for research and development and for product, for introduction of new products and for innovation. And in my personal discussions with the proponents, they have admitted that countries may well want to and should include some incentives and compensation to right holders with respect not just to patent rights, but with respect to trade secrets rights as well. And I think, it's correct that trade secrets are really the center of what's at dispute here. And in a way, we are left in a world where trade secret rights seem more absolute even than the patent rights. We have an elaborate system at present for compulsory licensing that apply to patents. But patents are insufficient at this point in time to transfer the technology and the know-how that's needed to manufacture new vaccines in a reasonable period of time. And, this is knowledge that was developed relatively quickly in the US, in a matter of months. It's actually been submitted to regulatory authorities who have a lot of that information sitting at the FDA and the emergency use authorization dossiers that have been submitted that give information on good manufacturing practices and quality control measures and the industrial process that is used to manufacture the vaccines. And I can't think of a good reason why government shouldn't begin to try to force companies, if they can't be persuaded to do so voluntarily, to force companies to begin to share that information, or actually to open the vaults of information they have. Admittedly, it's true in the United States at this time that there's no provision that will allow FDA officials to share that information with other producers at this time. That I think that's regrettable. I think we need a world in which we can move with greater speed and greater solidarity to respond to the global pandemic crisis that we are currently facing. So I think that, you know, the idea of the waiver is important, as both symbolically and regrettably, if needed, that to actually be implemented. And I'm glad that the U.S. government has supported it. So far, its support is only for vaccines. I don't think there's any question that other technologies are needed. And I think the one thing I kind of disagree with on the focus that the TRIPS agreement was well-balanced and sufficient to task is that it didn't really address the trade secret problem, because we just simply did not have the number of biologic medicines and kind of complex vaccines that we now realize we need, and how much of the technological knowledge that's required to actually produce those medicines now rests in trade secret confidential information intellectual property regimes, not in the patent regime. And if we think it's important to waive patents for small molecules so that we can actually have generic production, increased supply, and lower price, I can't think of any compelling reason why we shouldn't have a system that's equally effective to allow essentially generic production of vaccines when they're needed. I'll stop there.
Thanks very much. And to Matt Cleanup, Professor Rushman.
Thank you very much for this invitation. It's also my first time participating in an event hosted by the Federalist Society. And I'm really glad we get a chance to discuss this very polarizing topic. Let me just situate my background in this discussion, because never until I wrote an article essentially opposing the US's support for the waiver did I ever get called an IP maximalist. And I don't think that my views would accurately be described as such, although I'm obviously biased there. But although I recognize some of the strategic and PR value of the waiver, I don't like it as a legal tool. And partly, I think it's because my brain has been formatted to think of things very often as legal problems. And in my mind, if we are trying to use a particular legal tool, that tool has to first match some type of legal problem and has to be effective in solving that legal problem. I have a slightly different read on the underlying problem. It's, I think, a read that matches many of the things that have been said before, emphasizing the idea that we have an infrastructural and production-related problem. I think those are facts, right? From all the numbers available to us, we know those are facts. I am not sure we have a legal problem. In my view, this is a fundamentally different situation from the one that we faced during the HIV/AIDS crisis, which is ongoing, but the one that really triggered the application of a legal solution in the form of compulsory licensing a few years ago. I do see that match up there. Why? Because we have a small molecule drug, an area where trade secrecy is not going to be much of a de facto barrier. So what was the problem in the day? The problem standing between the available production, the available supply of those drugs, and those drugs actually getting to the populations in need. It was not an infrastructural problem. It was an artificial creation stemming from the application of certain laws or behaviors sanctioned or enabled by laws. So we had an artificial pricing problem, and availability problem tied to an exclusive right. And through the work of the very important work of many people, including Professor Biker, we were able either directly or through the pressure brought about this threat of compulsory licensing, you know, match the legal intervention to the underlying problem. Here, we have products that are utterly different. These are products, so small molecule drugs, much more simple, much less path dependent than vaccines. So biologics are macromolecular products. And to this day, we don't have, first, it's impossible to have a generic version of a vaccine, but we don't have biosimilar vaccines. It's not something that we have really even developed. And even if we were to magically lift today all sorts of legal protections that are in place in the form of intellectual property proper, we would have to contend still, as has been said over and over, with trade secrecy provisions. The waiver doesn't do that. So I see a fundamental mismatch here that I find somewhat worrisome, although I do recognize that in terms of applying pressure at the negotiable table so that those with decision-making power come together faster to seek solutions to address the underlying problem, I recognize the value of the waiver there, but I see this mismatch in terms of the legal intervention in question. Further to that, the article that I wrote saying this is not the right legal tool for the problem that we're facing, I did so in co-authorship with a lawyer who works currently for SAPI, one of the public-private partnerships that has been involved in the funding and coordination of the development of COVID-19 vaccines. And as many of you probably know, SAPI is precisely one of the entities right now leading the survey on production capabilities around the world. So we had some insight into what facilities throughout the world have been reporting in terms of what they can do within the next couple weeks, couple months, even a year, or so. And the outlook on this is far from encouraging. So even if there were no practical constraints whatsoever, including the trade secrecy issues that I'll get to in just a second, and on the reports that we've seen so far indicate that there is no capacity to scale up production of these vaccines, even if we did not have a trade secrecy problem, even if there were voluntary paid for transfer of technology. So again, we have a legal intervention that I see as a mismatch. And if we are worried really about trade secrecy being what's impeding the faster development of these vaccines, I personally don't see the pharmaceutical industry absent from the negotiating table in this particular issues. I can talk at length about many of my grievances about how innovation policy in this area often works, but this is not one of those cases. So I think we lack that that capacity, and the PR function of the waiver pressuring things or applying pressure on negotiation covering things like the sharing of existing doses of vaccines. I see the waiver as important on the one hand to do that, but I also see it as stealing a lot of attention on fronts like that. So a couple of days ago, and we've all here decried vaccine nationalism, and I think personally the U.S. and many other countries have been very late in committing to donate orders that they have and they're not using straight away. The U.S. just ordered a significant amount of vaccines, anticipating the possibility of boosters. The discussions about vaccine nationalism have, in my reading of the situation, died down in tone and frequency since we've started talking about the waiver. So I think there are some PR effects about the waiver that might detract from the fundamental and ultimate goals that we're all, I think, here trying to achieve, which is get the vaccines to the arms of those most in need. I'll end with a quick comment on the trade secret issues, because imagine that by doing things like making the information that has been submitted to the FDA, the EMA, or other agencies around the world available. Imagine that were possible and that somehow the infrastructural problem has been sorted out. I'm still not convinced that is going to be necessary. I share with Professor Baker the view that is regrettable, the stance that FDA, for instance, has taken since the 70s, interpreting the Code of Federal Regulations in a way that I find not very convincing, to say that information submitted to the FDA, a lot of this information is protected as a trade secret. But I don't think that, conversely, that means that all information that is currently held in some sort of trade secret or trade secret-like mode and not made public is actually accessible just by reading the information that's part of a regulatory submission. So we might be able, with the intervention proposed by Professor Bikert, and I would actually gladly support, solve some of the trade secrecy issues, but we still don't have all the information, all the ingredients we need to put together, in addition to the patent information, the regulatory information. There are other ingredients in the recipe, tacit knowledge, that you still don't catch from those submissions. And in the case of such a complex path-dependent product, I do see that as also a problem that we have to contend with. And I'm going to stop here, and I look forward to our discussion.
Great. Thank you all very much. Maybe I'll kick things off a little bit. As I understand it, there's not a lot of dispute that the patent owners in the vaccines have licensed those around the world to facilitate production of vaccine in facilities that are capable of that. I believe Moderna, maybe the most out front example, actually has a statement on their company website that they will not enforce their patent vaccine, a vaccine patent, against anyone. So I guess two-part, does anyone disagree that that's the case? And if that is the case, why? What benefit comes from a waiver of patent rights, allowing countries to suspend all patent rights related to the vaccines or anything else? Anyone who wants to jump in?
Well, I'll say, as I understand it, that Moderna has done that, but not all the manufacturers have. And there are literally now hundreds of patent applications filed and some published, but a lot more that are not published yet on vaccine technologies. And so we know that there's going to be a patent thicket in many countries. Of course, the patents aren't filed in every country, but they are in key producer countries. So Moderna has put those on the table. But I think, as we heard in the discussion from at least the last three of us who spoke, the big issue is not necessarily just patents and the vaccines. It's much more the technical know-how, the biologic resources, the data and knowledge that's needed to actually produce these more complex products.
And I agree with that too, to make it more.
And so, you know, it doesn't, I don't think it helps to frame this as, well, if there's a non-assert promise on patents that the problem is solved. Moderna has also made it clear that it's not willing to do technology transfer across the board at this point, though we also understand that it's in discussions now with the WHO technology transfer hub being set up in South Africa. And we can all hope that Moderna or Pfizer or anyone else will actually begin their share to technology more broadly. And I think if that happens, it will be partially as a result of the waiver discussions that have force the issue a bit.
I would throw in, you know, the vaccine. This is not a monolithic vaccine technology, right? The mRNA technology that Moderna and Pfizer are using is probably the most difficult technologically of the solutions to reproduce. So to think that somebody could reproduce it on a generic basis just with Moderna's patents, without Pfizer's patents, and without any of the know-how is, I think, just overly optimistic, right? I mean, there are other approaches to making vaccines that other manufacturers, Sinovac and others, are using that are probably easier. So it's quite partial. I mean, To Professor Baker, Moderna's message has been a little bit mixed, right? I mean, in their public pledge, they did, at least on their website, commit that they would try to effect some knowledge transfer. But, you know, again, I think it's a much bigger endeavor than you know, turning over some documents, especially with this technology.
And I would just quickly add to that, that even if we're just considering IP protected components of a vaccine or processes, the waiver and the type of technology coverage in Moderna's pledge or similar pledges, I think that's a fragment of the patented technology itself. Even if we set aside the know-how or trade secret problems, a lot of the things that you need to put together a vaccine are not COVID-19 vaccine specific. They might be adjuvant specific, or you know, you name one of the many, many components of a vaccine, and there's a host of intellectual property rights covering those, you know, amidst things that are licensed and so a lot of companies use and share among one another. So that's a concern to me when we say we are going to waive COVID-19 related patented technology for vaccines. What does that mean? What is that line there, right? So, and that's a legal question, right? And I'm not sure we know the answer to that. And also, I would not dare say anything other than the fact that I have many doubts about any voluntary pledges of non-assertion that are as scarce as the one that Moderna has made, in the sense that it's a very brief statement, and I'm not sure of its legal status, even after having read pretty much everything Professor Contreras has written on the topic. So that's an additional concern, in my view, that we don't really know what it means.
Professor Bacchus, please.
Returning to the TRIPS agreement, which is what is before the members of the WTO, I wanted to add to something Professor Baker said. He's right that the TRIPS agreement doesn't go nearly far enough in setting out the lines between exclusivity and access on trade secrets. That said, when the TRIPS agreement was concluded in the early 1990s, it was revolutionary in including the topic of trade secrets, as I'm sure he knows. Where we've been remiss is in not updating that and improving those provisions through the years. We've been remiss generally in the WTO in not updating a whole slew of existing rules to make them fit for purpose here in the 21st century, and especially in the pandemic world in which we find ourselves. In a paper I published last week that's online from CG, you know, I proposed a whole long list of updates that we need to make to move from TRIPS Pass to TRIPS Plus. And one of them was that I proposed exactly what I think Professor Baker has suggested, that we need to deal with the issue of biologics in the WTO and figure out how best to draw those lines in a way that continues to promote innovation, but also make certain that these innovations are made available to the people who need them when they need them. We've not done that. There have been some efforts in some piecemeal plurilateral, non-WTO free trade agreements and other regional agreements on this issue, but they've not been very helpful, nor have they approached the global multilateral standard that we actually need. One point for those who are not WTO people who are in the audience, it's important to understand that in contrast in some respects to say the World Bank or the IMF, there is nothing called the WTO that has any authority whatsoever to act on its own. The WTO is only the 164 countries that are members of the WTO acting together, and they choose to call the WTO. And if they can't agree to do something, they won't get done. It's not that the Director General can intercede and demand forced technology transfer. No, WTO is not the IMF.
Thank you. Yes. So we have a question from the audience, and let me set this up just a little bit. What we're focusing here on here in the discussion, particularly in the last few minutes, is, okay, we've got these vaccines. They work really well. Let's get them to as many people as possible, as fast as possible, and various ways and techniques necessary to do that. Questions about whether that's already being maximized, so on and so forth. But of course, the other side of the equation in any IP policy discussion is to think about the incentives for future innovation, because that's at least half the game in intellectual property. If you don't have new innovation, no one gets it. So the question from the audience is, does anyone on the panel think that there would be as rapidly and successfully produced new drugs and treatments in the future if this IP, and I'll wrap both patents and trade secrets into the phrase IP, is made publicly available, clearly setting a precedent? Put differently, how much would people invest in new drugs and treatments if they know that there's at least some risk that it's going to be taken from them, perhaps against their will, if someone perceives the need is great enough? Anyone want to go for that one?
I see Brooke making motions, but I'll jump in very briefly, and then so, you know, I don't think that this would have a huge effect on innovation incentives for a number of reasons. I mean, as Professor Barkas just mentioned, the WTO is not a world patent granting agency. It's up to individual countries what they do after this waiver is adopted, or even if it's not adopted. Countries then still have to enact some kind of national legislation to waive in some way their own national patent trade secret laws, with or without compensation. And there hasn't been a rush of countries showing that they're interested in doing that. In fact, on the trade secret front, there's been just one, which is Brazil, which is an interesting case, and that Brazilian legislation is still working its way through their approval process. But you have to remember that even if the United States supported whatever the final waiver proposal is, that really doesn't mean that the United States is going to waive or suspend IP rights in the United States. And I think that's highly unlikely that would ever happen. The U.S. Trade Representative has no authority over patents in the United States. It's just a very different sphere. And I think it would probably never happen in the U.S., Europe, or most other developed countries. So you're talking about developing countries primarily. The least developed countries, even if they did enact legislation that required trade secret transfers, they have no authority over the companies that are not based there. They have no leverage to require that to happen. So there's only this narrow band of countries in the middle in which companies have assets such as patents that a country can leverage to force them to then comply with some sort of FTT technology transfer requirement. Brazil, is you know, probably India and South Africa. I mean, that's probably the group, and maybe a few others. So it's a small group, and just based on the procurement dollars that we've seen so far, I think companies can make a very handsome profit by selling the vaccines and therapeutics and whatnot in the United States, North America, Europe, and the developed Asian countries, that I think would be very little impact on incentives to innovate.
I would just add, I mean, there have to be incentives to innovation, but the IP system and the monopoly and high prices associated with monopolies and scarce supplies need not be the only way to fund it. And in fact, we saw that in this case. We see that most of the background research on vaccines over the past two decades has come from governments more so than from private industry. For quite some time, private industry has kind of shied away from vaccines, and it's been disinvestment in vaccines by major pharmaceutical companies for many years now. They're getting interested now, especially with this experience, but But most of the, you know, the background research has been NIH, you know, supported in the recent past.
Well, one option, Brooke, would be simply for governments, including our own, to get serious about helping other countries and ante up billions of dollars to ramp up production and pay for distribution and get these vaccines to where they're needed, which is the opposite of what we've been doing up until now. And to the extent some IP holder has benefited from public largesse, well, the price can be adjusted for the public purchase. But, you know, the best thing the United States can do to protect people in the United States, the citizens of the United States, is to make sure that we end the pandemic worldwide. But what have we been doing? We've been trying to convince people, many of them who refuse to be convinced, that they need to take the vaccine when they may not necessarily be the people who are most at risk. And the people who are most at risk in the rest of the world have no chance to get it. I mean, that 2% in Africa that you mentioned is perfectly accurate. And that is shameful in terms of thinking about the supposed generosity of the United States of America, not to mention a few other countries. But, you know, one option is simply to pay for what's needed. And no one's even considering that, so far as I can tell. Little dibs and drabs, but the global efforts that have been put in place to try to deal with this in that type of multilateral way, COVAX and others, have been poorly funded by the rich countries of the world. That is just shameful.
And I would just quickly add, one of the, I think, most viable blueprints going forward is what we've learned from the Serum Institute in India, right? They perceive the infrastructure problem, and to some degree, they addressed that before this pandemic, right? Which puts us at the margin, in a marginally better place globally in terms of vaccine production than we would have been otherwise. Now, I think this is a big wake-up call, and I think countries in Africa and Latin America might consider a similar attempt. I think the incentives coming for all of this are not intellectual property incentives, are not market incentives. I think they're completely detached here from traditional IP incentives. It's the need that we've seen over and over and over to produce vaccines against emerging pathogens. Now we have a global one, the next one might not be global. So I think that regional production of vaccines is going to be a big key in the future. I can't make predictions on how much discussions related to the waiver will impact or speed up the formation of those regional hubs, but I think that's where we are either headed or should be headed in the near future globally. And I don't think I have time to go into the domestic scene, but globally, I think that's a big and important development that needs to happen.
So we just have a minute or so left, and I personally have a background in copyrights, and so we haven't talked about that yet, and I want to put that out there, at least for the last minute. The proposed waiver, both the original and revised versions, apply to not only patents and trade secrets that we've spent a lot of time discussing this afternoon, but also to copyrights, which apply to things like music and books and movies and so on. Now, I've seen some justifications that, well, you know, when people are in quarantine, they need to be able to stream their entertainment for free. That wasn't particularly convincing to me, but let me throw it out there for all of you. Is there a reason related to vaccines that we would want to allow countries to suspend copyright protection?
It's more in the means of production and some of the codified information that's available. So, you know, no one's talking about records and movies and entertainment related IP. And I think the proponents have tried to make that as exquisitely clear as they can. But they're industrial blueprints. Software is supported, you know, protected in some countries. You know, operational software is supported in some countries or protected by copyright. Manuals, you know, formula data collections can all receive various kinds of protection. And I think that's what people are talking about. They're really talking about what is needed to make a medical technology that responds to COVID that helps prevent, treat, and contain the disease. Those are the rights that are being referred to. So I know the industry was quite concerned, well, does this mean, as you say, they want streaming while they're sitting in the hospital bed? I don't think that's anyone has really seriously suggested on the proponent side that that's what they're talking about. But they are talking about, you know, the means of production and the embedded copyright material that's in a lot of diagnostics, in particular, not as much in vaccines, except in production methods.
I think that's right. I think his description is right on, exactly.
Okay. Well, for what it's worth, I've seen things that do indicate a broader application from proponents, but I guess to each their own. Anyhow.
I would oppose that if they have, but I don't think that's really what they're contemplating.
I hope not.
Look, I'm a reformed politician. That's some of the rhetoric you use. And they're using it on both sides, of course. I don't think the pharmaceutical industry is evil. I think it's done a wondrous thing here from which we're all benefiting. The question is, you know, how long should they have these exclusive rights and what types of profits should they be allowed to make and for how long?
Well, I guess that's our last note for this afternoon. Thank you all very much. This issue will continue to be discussed and debated both within the United States and in Congress and at the World Trade Organization among 164 countries. So we'll see what happens. Certainly, we all hope that COVID's defeated one way or the other very soon. Thank you all for your participation.
Thank you very much. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their very valuable time. It was a great discussion this afternoon. And I want to thank our audience for participating and sending in questions. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. Please keep an eye on your emails for upcoming announcements about teleforums and virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.